Okay, shall we start? So what I want to do in this lecture is to talk a little bit about design and finite state machines, and to give you a little bit of practice for that. So that's the practical thing I want to do. It gives me a chance to reintroduce transducer finite state machines, which we had at the very beginning. Remember, they're the ones where you have input and output along the arcs on the finite state machine. And to talk a little bit, I'll do that at the beginning, about life cycles and how these sorts of systems fit into system life cycles. So maybe the first thing to talk about is why, in general, it's a good idea to be careful about design. So I guess quite a lot of you will, like everybody else, you read the newspapers from time to time and you hear about catastrophic failures of the sort of systems that our kind of folk tend to build. So typically, they'll either be catastrophes where you have, you know, airplanes fall out of the sky or something, and there's some worry that there might be some fault that software or systems related that would contribute to that. Or sometimes, actually, to some extent, I think more commonly, it's project failures. It's that a whole lot of money was put into a software project, and you know, it went on for ages and ages, and even more money was spent, and in the end, the whole thing really wasn't fit for purpose, and it failed for various reasons, and so on. Right? I suppose everybody has seen examples of that. That's one of the reasons why the software industry tends to have, I would say, actually, given the complexity of what we build, an undeservedly bad reputation, because we build very, very complex things at great expense, and sometimes they fail. That's true for other industries that aren't the software industry, by the way. You just need to look at the Edinburgh tram system at the moment, and you'll see a good example of a project that really overran its budget that isn't particularly a software system. So lots of things fail like this, but software is particularly prone to it, and here's why. So the two issues are here and here. So the first look at this one first. So this is the issue about if you find a problem in your software system, what's the amount of time, or you could have measured it in money, or you could have measured it in effort, whatever measure you want to use of just general badness there's a whole lot of people come in. Maybe I start a little bit early. Let's just stop for a moment, while you find yourselves a seat. Apologies if I stopped earlier. It is a rainy day, so that does make it more difficult. It takes more time to get to places. I do understand. Okay, jolly good, jolly good. Okay, so where was I? Yes. Okay, so you're building a large software system, and the issue is, if you're going to have some problem in the design of your code or of your system, where would you rather find it? Here are different places. These aren't the only places, but these are some. One, and this is more or less. This is more or less in. Oh, this light doesn't work too well. In the order of time. So one could be when you're doing the early design, when you build the equivalent to your finite state machine model that's talking about the behavior of the system. And when you're reviewing that, you find the problem. Usually doesn't take long to fix it, because you just got that design to revise, and probably it's a reasonably focused exercise. And revising it isn't hard. You don't have to have a huge dialogue, because you haven't gone very far down the process of building the thing. Next one might be when you take that model and then you turn it into code. So remember I was saying with finite state machines, especially non-deterministic ones, there is a significant step turning that into something that is a machine, that would be code. Because you're taking things where various decisions are just not described into things where they must be described, otherwise it won't execute. And so once you get to that and you're starting to code, you have many, many more decisions built in, and they all interweave. Because, say, you were doing it in Haskell, it was a functional program you were building from your finite state system, then you've made lots and lots of decisions about how to build your Haskell program, that now that you find the problem, you're now going to have to unravel all of those as well as the design. So it's, you know, it's a bit more awkward, but not so much more, because probably you've got a reasonably tight link. Code review, again, then if you hit an error there, you have some unraveling to do, but it's not so extreme. Once you get to the sort of compile time, when you're compiling the code and starting to start to ship it out, it's starting to get harder, because your system is getting more and more embedded inside the other systems with which it has to interact, the particular platform it's going to work on, the particular environment that it's going to work in, and so on. All of those decisions you've now started to make. Yes, a question. That's true. Ah, okay. So that's a different question. So, Okay. Let me answer it now. I was going to say wait until later, but let me answer it now. So, what I'm describing is an error that could have been caught earlier on, but you catch later, right? Some parts of the process that you introduce will introduce new things that have new potentials for error. So if I take my finite state machine model and I say, I will, in the end, I'll build it in, I don't know, C or something. And then I code it in C. And then at compile time, there's something wrong with my coding. It's conceptually the right thing, but just something wrong with my coding. Sure, there'll be errors that get trapped at compile time. And if that's the only thing that's wrong, probably I'll catch it then and I won't have to do very much. But if there's an error with my original design, and I catch it when I turn it into C, and I only get it at the point where I'm starting to interface with the rest of the environment and so on, then that's a bigger issue, because I have to go further. So there are more errors that you trap there. Errors tend to accumulate as you go through. I'll talk in a moment about errors accumulating as you go through. But for the ones that you conceptually could have trapped earlier, better to go earlier, right? Yes. So then the other thing I could say is, of course, there are other errors that you could introduce to do with how you fit into the environment that weren't in the original design that are also catastrophic. But I'm kind of ignoring those, right? Those only make the problem worse. They don't solve it in any way. Okay. So the other possibility is when you're in the test phase, when you're rolling out the thing and you're testing it with people, maybe as some sort of beta test version or something like that, and you hit errors there. Okay, so those may make you want to revise the design, and when you hit those errors, then you're going to have to go all the way back through the compile, the stuff you did to make it compile and all this sort of stuff, and unravel those. Or worst of all, use. So you actually roll the thing out, it's with your users, they're spotting errors, and not only then do you have to roll back, but you have some more constraints now, because actually you've got it out with people who are now using it and now have expectations based on what the first thing that they saw. And so it becomes even more difficult to try and unravel it and do all that. So what I'm really giving you here isn't, well, there's quite a lot of empirical backing for believing this, but it's not an empirical rule or anything. It's just kind of accumulated experience from lots of people building software. This is kind of the way it plays out. So you want, basically what this is you'd like to trap those errors early, which is one reason for being careful about design. The other one down there is another reason. So this is a very crude model, but I think it's a nice. This is not a precise model. It looks precise because it's a bit of maths. It's not precise. It's a bit of maths that's just explaining an idea. It's precise in its little mathematical world, but it's a very crude model of what's going on. So if P over there is the probability that a program is fault-free, what I'd like is for P to be very low. I want that probability to be very high, right? So I'd like it to be 1. I'd like my programs to be fault-free. That would be great. But the trouble is, every one of these individual PIs, the P1, P2, and so on, up to PN for each one of these stages, imagine that I'm building my system in stages. I build a bit of it, and then I build another one, and there's a whole lot of stages in my design, which is typically true for anything that's a big project. You don't just build it in one go. And so each one of these is the probability that I'm going to inject the fault just because of the way I'm doing the design. Okay, I just make a mistake somehow in my design. And the trouble is that those, so then at any one of these stages, the probability that I'm going to have an error-free program is 1 minus the probability that I inject a fault, right? So it's the inverse of the probability that I inject a fault. Right? Happy about that. I have all those stages. I have a probability of screwing up in some way in my design, and then the probability that it's fault-free is going to be that. All of the inverses multiplied together. And the really bad thing about that is, imagine that I have a very nice process for building my software. It's lovely. But at one stage, I screw up. At some point, one of these PIs gets pretty high. Then suddenly, the probability that my software is going to be fault-free collapses. Gets very low, because we're multiplying these together. It's a big and, right? So if at one stage I have a high probability of injecting a fault, then the whole process that I've got loses an awful lot of its integrity. So that's the second reason why you need to be very, very careful about design. First one, the one we last talked about says to you, if I screw up, I have lots of stages. When you build software, then typically there are lots of stages in design. I'll talk about that in a moment. You want each one to be very high integrity, because if one of them screws up, there's a very high probability that my whole process is going to get screwed up, because it's a big and. Furthermore, I don't want to get into the stage that I've left it so long to find out that I'm over on the right-hand side of that chart, because then it's going to be an awful lot of effort to pick it up. And when you take those two things together, I know they're very crude models, and they are very simple approximations, but more or less they sum up why software is really hard at large scale to build. It's a really difficult thing to do. And that explains why there's so much of a software engineering industry trying to keep this under control. And if you do this for longer, you'll find out that there are lots and lots of methods. Some of them are quite specific to particular industrial needs. Some of them are much more generic. Different ones used to try to keep this under control. Let me give you one example. So this is a fairly kind of standard V model for software design. So finite state machines typically get used kind of down at quite a low level, down at the specification level. But there are other levels where sometimes you get finite state machines used or something a bit like that. So let me just explain this to you for a moment. None of this is essential for exams or anything, by the way. This is really just context to help you understand why you're doing all this stuff. Okay, so the way that one of these kind of models work is you read it down the left and then back up to the right. And this is a very idealized model. Life doesn't really life doesn't work just by going down and back up there for reasons I'll explain. So typically what would happen would be you'd have some way of expressing the requirements of what you want to build. Okay, and that could be done depending on the industry you work in. That'll be done in different ways. It might be very informal. You talk to your clients or something. Maybe it's on a small scale, you talk to your clients. Maybe it's precisely formal in particular ways. For example, it's some type of safety critical application where in order to build the system, you must have a very precise requirement specification of what you're going to build. So depending on the industry, that's different. Then there's typically some, based on that, you typically build some architecture specification. And the link from the one to the other might again be informal, because you're looking at what people said and then you try to build it, or it may be quite precise. It might be at the requirement stage, you have something that closely resembles a finite state machine, and then the architecture model is somehow almost derived from that, or at least refined from that. Then from the architecture model, which is scoping out the general shape of your system and what connects to what and the major components and all of that, you specify the lower level detail of what it will do. Okay, and that's typically where things like finite state machines are often very helpful, because they allow you to get to the grips of the actual functional behavior of your system. And then there's a coding step where you turn it into software or hardware or some mixture of those things. And then the nice thing about this model is then there's some nice steps back up the other way. Then you want to know whether the thing that you built down here corresponds to what was up there, because if it doesn't, you may be in trouble. You may not get paid, or the system may not work well, or it's unsafe, or something. So you want that line to have quite high integrity. So you do some verification and validation steps. So you take the software or hardware you've constructed, and you verify it against the specification. So you're taking the design that you did in the specification, looking at the code that you did, doing some verification. So the red lines are commitments that you made carrying across once you're doing the checking. Then you might take the specification and the architecture model that you have and verify that against the architecture. Then you might take the verified architecture, the requirement spec that you had, and validate the requirements against the specification. Okay, so that's the kind of idealized model. Wouldn't it be great if you could just do that the way I said? But of course, it's much more complicated because you hit problems. And then you could hit a problem anywhere in this V model, and then you have to somehow gracefully backtrack and cycle around. And that's what makes a lot of it much, much more complicated than I described. But that's a basic model that's used quite a lot. Of course, nowadays, that as the world moves on and software engineering itself gets rather more fluid, then there are very, very different models that you use. I don't know, an example would be, say, extreme programming, where instead of having an awful lot of structure, what you rely is on a very, very tight relationship between people who want to build the software and often, in fact, for extreme programming, definitely pairs of programmers working on very closely with clients, just building that very rapidly and prototyping very quickly and comparing. But it's a completely different way of doing it from this one. So there's lots and lots of different models, but all of them rely on some notion of design that can be reviewed. Even extreme programming, which is kind of the most kind of intense, close to client type of thing. The reason why there's a pair of programmers is because one's looking over the shoulder of the other and checking the design of the person who's actually doing the coding. So even there, design is a very, very key element. So that's just to give you a motivation for this. Now what I'm going to do is to move on to the bit that's a bit more technical for you. And what I'm going to do is give you an example of a transducer design and then get you to build another one yourself. That's how it's going to work. So data projector, like one of those. So here's an example of a kind of simple requirement specification for a data projector. And it's an informal language, but we're going to link it into a finite state machine. So here are my three requirements. I have to be able to control the input from either the computer or the video. So I have a computer, I have some kind of thing like this that's controlling it, and I want to be able to control it from both. Second requirement is I should be able to switch between the computer and the video while the data projector is in operation. And the third requirement is that the power button has to be pressed twice to switch off. So I don't want to be able to just press the power button once and it Actually, you kind of saw me almost do that with, if you were paying attention at the very beginning of the previous lecture, when I took a little bit of time to start up, I actually pressed one of these buttons and the damn thing shut down. And then it takes ages to start up again because it's trying to save the power on the bulb. Question? It means twice sequentially. With that input between the two, I think. Yeah, that'll do. Okay. So those are the requirements. Oh, actually, I should say, so these aren't the only sorts of requirements you would typically get for software, of course. These are functional requirements. They're talking about the functionality you want from the device that you're going to build. Because they're all defined in terms of what it is that the system should do. Plenty of requirements that aren't like this in the world, that non-functional requirements. So non-functional requirement, I don't know, probably not for one of those things, might be that it looks pretty or something. That's not really a functional requirement, right? Or it improves my presentational style. That's not really a functional requirement because it's not something I can define as part of the functionality of the system. It might be a very important requirement for me to have, but it's not a functional one, so we're linking into those. Okay, so first thing you want to do is to talk about you're going to build a finite state machine. It's going to be a transducer. So we talk about the inputs. So here are the inputs that I'm going to use. And if this thing still had, so there's power. So these are all going to be inputs to my finite state machine. So they'll appear as input labels on the arcs, right? There's power, And what that means is that there's a signal going from the on-off button on the remote control to the power on the projector. There's the mode button, which is a signal from the mode button on the remote control. And there's a time signal it's a timeout signal from the system clock. So those are inputs that can come into my data projector. I'm describing the data projector now. So it can get three, two of which come from the remote control. I have a remote controller. One can come from the system clock. And then there are six outputs. You may, of course, think of a better way to design a control system for a video projector. I'm sure you would if you thought for long enough, but this is the one I'm going to give you. These are all to the control system. So an on signals the system to start up. An off signals the system to shut down. Or you can get a C, which says take your input from the computer. So it's one of these, and it's taking the input from here. Or V says take the input from the video. There's probably some video thing down here, and the input will go. That thing will be told to take its input from the video. Or there's a signal that says suspend your normal operation, or there's the signal that says resume normal operation. And now I'm going to give you the finite state machine. And then after I've done this one, then we'll do another one that you get to think about. Right? So, okay, here's one way to do it. It's not the only way to do it. You might find a better way to do it, but it's the way I'm going to give you. This machine has five states. Starting state, which initially is off, switched off at the very beginning. And I wish I had this laser pointer working, because then I could I'm afraid you're going to have to live with this thing. I think the battery is more or less run down, so occasionally it's going to work. So starting off, and then you can switch on the signal to power. A signal from the remote saying power is received as input. And then it says on to the controller and the video projector, right? Switches the video projector on. It's on. The default is it's taking input from the computer. I just chose that because I thought that was a good idea. If you hit the mode button on the remote controller, then the signal goes to switch to video, and it's in the state where it's taking input from the video and on. If you hit mode again, it signals to switch over to the computer, and it's in the state where it's in the computer and on, taking input from the computer and on, right? So it's just toggling between the video and the computer. You press the power button, then it goes into a suspension state where it's waiting, and it's still in computer mode here. If you press that again, it goes off, right? Sends a signal to go off, and it's in the off state. If you press the mode button, then it's still waiting and in computer state. Okay, you could make a decision about that, whether you wanted it to do that or not. After a period of time, it resumes normal operation. So you press the power button on your remote once, then it goes into that state there. Until you either press the button again, or the time has elapsed and you get a message from the system clock and it goes back into its normal state again. In other words, you pressed it once, but nothing, you didn't press it the second time. What else? And the same thing symmetrically here. So this is just with the video on, the same thing. Exactly the same thing. So these bits of it are just symmetrical. Right? Mm. What do you mean? Oh, this one. Let me see. What's this? This is, now let me see. Is this a mistake? It could be a mistake. It could be power, in which case there should be one here, though, then, as well, shouldn't there? Oh, no, but that's going there. No, it's not power, because power goes into this one, because you're going to press it twice, right? So power should take you here, and there's mode and there's time. I think this one is an error. I think this is just an error. Yes, sorry about that.
Could that be epsilon?
No, we don't. No, there's no epsilons in this one. You don't need them in this one. Okay, happy with that? Right, so that's my design. But what about my requirements? So then you look at your design and see whether this is, so here's the verification bit, which I'm going to do informally. You could imagine doing this maybe automatically. Okay, so first requirement was I must be able to control the input from either the computer or the video. Okay, so I look at my system, and here's my computing on state, and here's my video state. So those are the bits where it's in operation and receiving input from the computer or receiving input from the video. And if I look through, here's my start state. So what this is really saying is, from the starting state, I should be able to either get to the state, to this state, or this state. And yep, that's true, because what I need to do is to press the power button, I get to here. I press the mode button, I get to here, and vice versa. So that's true. Right? All of my requirements, I'm going to do this way. I'm going to look at the diagram, and I'm going to show that the transitions enable me to get the requirement that I described. In some ways, actually, this is an aside, and I'm not doing it in this lecture, but there are some parallels to what we were doing in logic when we were looking at the protocol, if you remember, where we were looking at sequences of events. But I'm not going to dwell on that, but there are some similarities there. Okay, next one is, I should be able to switch between the computer and the video while it's in operation. Okay, so then here's the computer, and we're in operation, it's on, video it's on, and yes I can, because I can go from this state to this state by hitting mode, this state to this state by hitting mode, and I can keep doing that for as long as you like. And I suppose I could say there are no other states where a computer or video are on where I can't do the toggling. Third one is that I have to press the power button twice to switch off. So here we go. So that's a little more complicated, but because the other ones I just had to show you the path. This one I have to look across the whole thing and show that to get to that state, the only way I can get to it is through these other states. Yes?
The red box is actually true. You can input power, mode, power, and switch off as long as time has been retained.
I can input. Depends what you mean by consecutive, I suppose. Depends whether you were interested in what depends on whether you're interested in what the mode button does, which I'm not, actually. So I understand why you're asking the question, because sort of your first question I answered wrongly, because I did say consecutive. It's not really consecutive. Yes, because you can press a mode button in between, as you say, and you can still get it. So if I wanted it to be consecutive, then I'd have not to have this, I'd have this, oh no, wait a minute. Yeah, no, but this is okay. Depends what you mean by consecutive, but I think this is right. Because the issue is, I have a piece of hardware that's got a mode button on it. What this guarantees is that whenever I press the mode button, nothing happens. Right, it's just exactly back to the same state. Nothing has happened except I pressed the mode button. There was no output to anything. Right? So the only way that I get an output to anything is if I press the power button twice. So there's not much alternative than to have this mode button here, right? It takes me right back to the current state. It does nothing at all. And there isn't really another design that would be better than this, because the mode button would then have to go to some other state, and what would it be? It's the same state.
Well, if you actually were requiring that we press the power button twice without input between it, then mode wait C would go to video on, and mode wait B would go to prompt on.
So you want this to go to the video one?
Yeah, because if it went to wait B, then power mode and power would still turn off.
That would be another way of doing it. It depends on whether you want the mode button to do anything at that point. I don't know. Choose whichever. It doesn't matter to me. So other folk understand the distinction in this argument. So the distinction is, if I press the power button once, and then if I press the mode button, though I want it to do nothing at all, so then if I press the power button the second time, it will go off. Or when I press the mode button, do I want it to switch over to video if I'm in the computer or vice versa? I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you know, requirements issue. You'd have to talk to whoever wanted the projector to be built, I guess. So anyway, get the idea. Given this one, though, then the issue is, can I get to here? The requirement is, to get to here, it must be true that the only way I can get here is if I press the power button twice. And I couldn't ever get there pushing the power button only once. And then you exhaustively search, right? So every path to here goes through two power. Sorry, this light thing isn't working very well. But you can see it goes through two power clicks. Mm.
Does the remote input has to be there?
Does the remote... You mean to do the power off bit?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
If we had 100 different buttons, every other input would go back to wait C.
Oh, you mean other buttons that did other functionality or something?
Yeah.
I guess, but we don't have any other buttons, so I don't have to address that, do I? I mean, that would be a different device, I suppose. What would the other buttons do? Oh, this is not an acceptor finite state machine, remember. It's not. Oh, but maybe that's not what you mean. You mean there just would be no... Not quite sure what you're getting at.
Could be a trap state, I think you mean, like leave it empty, leave it blank.
Yeah, but we definitely want two power inputs to take us to the off state. We definitely want that.
Yeah.
But we want only two. Mm-hmm. Oh, so couldn't this go to some other trap state where nothing at all happened? That would be a bad idea, because then you're just sitting there with nothing happening forever in your projector. So that would be a bad idea. You don't want a trap state. Oh, you not have it there at all? Oh, yeah, but then the question is whether that's a good design for your finite state machine, because you do really want to be able to account for, I actually don't know whether I've done it for all of them, but it's probably a good idea to be able, for this one, to be able to account for all of the possibilities for inputs.
Yeah, but we've got another button, I mean, in the original design. Do we have to write it next to mode? I mean, when we press another button, we turn back to wait to...
Which?
Mm-hmm. We have to write all them in this.
The behaviors of all of them in the...
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, because you wouldn't normally have 100 buttons for a system like this. If you had a system with 100 buttons where you were really interested in the behavior of every button all the time, then the answer is yes. And if the answer is you had a system with 100 buttons where you weren't, then the answer probably is no.
So
depends on your system.
Off state should also show mode going back to itself?
Which?
Off state.
Oh, actually, that's a good point. I haven't put that one in. What happens if you press mode when you're in the off state? And I guess it should go back to itself. I'm making that up, but yeah.
When we're in state, phone, and video on, what happens when you press time?
Oh, time is an input that comes from, that's not what you're pressing, that's coming from the system clock. So probably that's best left alone. So more questions. I don't mind questions on this. It's good. It's good that you ask questions.
So you would leave time out of video and comp on.
Yeah. But all of these things, I'm answering to you, just as somebody who's been designing this. I mean, all of these answers are system design type answers, where the answer is not, you know, absolutely and forever, you know, God ordained that was the way to do it. I'm just describing the way I've designed this thing, and so you know, those decisions are mine. And it's actually part of the. I mean, you will have noticed you had more questions about this than almost anything else in the other lectures, and that's completely normal. That's what typically happens when you start to do these designs. That's why software engineers get kind of freaked out sometimes with the number of dialogues that they have about the designs of the software they build. That's why that can be quite an intense process. So, talking about intense processes, here's one for you. So here's what we're going to do with the time that we have left, which, yeah, we got enough time. So this time you're going to have a go, give you something to do on Friday afternoon for 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes, whatever you feel you need. cruise control system. Typically, I've used this example before, and typically it causes a whole lot of dialogue because people go, we want to build it this way, we want to build it that way, and that's fine. There's no particular good way to build this. It's just giving you a little bit of experience thinking about it. So you know what a cruise control system is? I have to admit I've never driven a car with a cruise control system, so I don't have any really good knowledge of how a cruise control system works. But the way I think it works is like this. So you're driving along in your car, and your cruise control system is something you can switch on that keeps your speed going at a constant speed. Very nice in the motorways, stops you having to keep pressing the accelerator and you just drive. But of course you want it to be safe. So if you brake or you accelerate, you want your car to change. So happy with what a cruise control system is on something like a car? Ask a question. Well, there would be an off state in it, if that's what you mean, when it's disabled.
Hmm? So is the idea that if it's turned on and the finite state machine starts, it's turned off and the finite state machine ends, or should there be a state?
So what you will have, this is a good question. So what you really, and I didn't explain that in the first one, maybe I should, that you're not really building the cruise control. What you're not specifying is the cruise control system itself, but the controller for it. So if you imagine building in your car, there is the cruise control system. It's doing whatever it is that it's doing. It will be some complex piece of mechanics and electronics that's actually making the cruise control system work. But what we're describing now is a little controller for it that's going to be kind of the interface that's telling it what to do, right? So off means that the cruise control system is disengaged, and on means that it's operating. Okay, so here we go. Here are some requirements. First requirement is the driver has to be able to turn the cruise control system off. So it's not working, it's in your normal controls or operating your car. Second one is that the driver has to be able to tell the system to maintain the current speed, otherwise it's not a cruise control. Third one is that the cruise control system shouldn't operate after you apply the brakes. If you apply the brakes, you don't want to be maintaining speed, or you're going to have a bit of tension there. I don't know why I'm laughing, that would be bad. The cruise control system, just like every cartoon you ever saw. And the fourth one is the cruise control system must allow the driver to travel faster than set speed by using its throttle. So this one is, when you brake, you better brake and not the system working against you. This one is when you accelerate, you better accelerate and not the system keep effectively slowing you down. Okay? So those are your requirements to think about. Well, at the end of this, I'll put up the design that I prepared earlier and talk about the requirements. So we'll do that. There's no pressure on you or anything. But we'll get a bit of practice for you designing the system. So since you're going to have a go at it, then you better know what the inputs are. Here are some inputs. If you can't be bothered with these, I mean, try some other ones. But these are the ones that I'm going to use for the example that I'll give you. So here are the inputs that can come into this control system from the driver. One is the on-off button. So you have a button that you can press, switch it on or switch it off. Another one is the thing that sets the cruise control to the current speed. So you say set it to the current speed. Another one is, that's from the driver. Another one is that you press the brake. So that's a signal coming from your brake. Another one is your accelerator signal. You press the accelerator. Another one is to say that you release the accelerator. Another one is a signal saying you want to resume traveling at the speed you set. So that's all the things that you can give as inputs through the whatever controls are given to you in the car. Here are signals that can come to the from the control system. So one says, the car is at the correct speed. Another one says the car is slower. And another one says that it's faster. So this is from the thing that's doing the cruise control, saying, oh, I'm going slower than the speed you set. Oh, I'm going faster. I'm going at the right speed. Okay. Like that. Here are the outputs. So it can store the current speed, or it could increase the throttle or decrease the throttle. That's what it can tell the car to do. Okay. This may not be the best way to specify it. I mean, okay, this is the simplest way. Simplest way, and almost certainly inaccurate, because my experience of control cruise control is zero. But it's an interesting little system to think about. It's got a little bit more behaviors than a simple video projector. So, off you go. Have a go. Try and draw out a finite state machine for it. We'll take what?
Could you go back?
Well, actually, we only have about 5 minutes to do it. So, ask.
Sorry.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask something. No.
So, could you go back one slide?
Back one slide. Oh, yeah. Sure. We've only got about 5 minutes, I see, so we're not going to take a huge amount of time. But have a go. Think about what it might look like. And in 5 minutes, you're not going to get it done very well unless you're really a whiz at doing this kind of stuff. But what it will do is make you think. Oh, I see. Yes. Well, so the inputs here you can think of as being all of these things in the left hand column are like your input language, the input alphabet. So here, yeah, and all the things on the next slide on the left hand column are the output alphabet. Yeah. Whatever. I forget the symbol. It doesn't really matter. Oh, question.
So when you accelerate over the set speed, you really has to go back to the set speed
for that? I really can't remember for the one that I did. What would be a good decision? I guess it should. I can't remember what I did. There's a whole lot of decisions in here that I just can't really remember. It's hard to hold them in your mind after you've done. Actually, that's one reason for doing the design, is because once you've done it, it's really hard to remember the decisions. But of course, if I went back to the, once we go back to the design, you'll see what they were. Oh yeah, does it? Oh, you know, you know more than I do. Oh, I see. With actual ones. Oh, I was talking about the design that I did. I can't remember what I did. Okay, when the muttering begins to start, I take that as my signal to move on with the lecture. Shall I give you the one? I mean, you've got some way through this. I mean, really, the only reason for getting you to have a go yourself is just to start getting you thinking in that mold rather than just kind of falling asleep when I show you the actual finite state machine. But can I show you the one I've got, which I am not claiming is the optimal finite state machine for this, but it's the one that... Oh, sorry, more outputs. Oh, sorry. Oh, these are the states. Oh, actually, sorry, I had more outputs. Storing. Oh, no, I had that. So, okay, you got that. Here are the states that I'm using. Okay. So it's the off state, which means the system is off. The ready state, which means that it's switched on, but there's no speed set. The set state, which means that the speed's set and the system's maintaining it. The wait state, where the speed is set, but the brake's pressed, the system is waiting for you to resume. And this act state, where the accelerator's been pressed, but it hasn't been released, right, to override the cruise control. Okay? And so here we are. This is what we got. So here's the start state, where it's off. And for any of these guys, it stays off. If you switch it on, it goes into the ready state. If you switch it off, it goes off again. This is the on-off button. When it's in the ready state, you can brake and do whatever you like, and it stays ready. But once you press set, then it sends the instruction to store that speed. And then it's in the state where the speed is set. And then you can press the fast button to this is the wrong way around, I think. Fast should be increment, shouldn't it? And slow should be decrement, I guess. Or you can get the signal that it's at the correct speed. If you brake, it goes into a wait state. With the system switched off. From the wait state, you can resume, and you're back into the set state. From the set state, if you press the accelerator, you're in the state where the accelerator is pressed. If you then brake, it goes back into the wait state. If you release the accelerator, it goes back into the set state, where the system is doing its cruise control. What else have we got? From wait, if you press the off button, it goes back to the off state. So maybe it's not the best one, but it's my design, right? So it's just like you. If you're building this stuff, if it was one of the ones that you'd written down, you've got something that looks a bit like this, but done your way. So then you have to go back to your requirements and do the verification bit. So here's the requirements. First one, driver has to be able to turn the cruise control system off. So what that means, and you always want to be able to turn the damn thing off, right? Or you're in trouble. So that means that all the states that I've got, all of these four, have to go to the on-off state, which they do, right? So from every state in my finite state machine, pressing the on-off button takes me to off. Good news for me if I don't want to die. Next one is driver has to tell the system to maintain the current speed. So that's the bit where all the states go to the set state via a driver command. So I can say, so here it's where I say set, and it goes to the set speed. Here it's a resume, and here's another set one that takes me there. So I'm rattling through these fast because we're just about out of time. Third one is the cruise control system. This is a negative one. It can't operate after braking. So braking, here's the bit where I do a brake, or brake there, or a brake there, or a brake there, or that one. None of those guys goes directly to that set state. So there's always something else I have to do before I can go to set. I don't know whether that's the best way to satisfy that requirement, but that's one argument. You may say that's not enough of an argument, but okay. Okay. And the fourth one, driver has to be able to go faster than set speed using the accelerator. So that's from set and wait, where the speed is set. If I press the accelerator, that's the ACP thing, I get to the accelerating state, right? So, oops, sorry. Oh, okay. So that was the last bit, and we're just out of time. So the main thing to take away from that is you should go away and get some practice in trying simple examples with these transducer finite state machines. And then the interesting thing is to be able to look at the requirements that you want for your system and check them. And a good way of checking them is by looking at the states and the transitions and properties over those. Thank you very much. See you next week.